Are you working on your author career but struggling to get that first book published? Does the goal of being an author seem too lofty? Or are thoughts of having multiple books and making a full-time living are as fantastical as living in Cinderella's castle? Welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths, a podcast where aspiring authors can be heard. Join Stephen Schneider as he finds and talks to authors you may not know, but authors that have gotten their foot on the author career path. Hear what they've done to get there and where they want to go now. Settle back. It's time for a bit of inspiration and advice. Come listen to today's Discovered Wordsmith.
All right, welcome to episode 83 of Discovered Wordsmiths. This is the second interview with David Ray. He was on early on in the podcast, and he's come back to give us a little update about his Crow series. We talk a little bit about issues faced. Don't really come up with a good solution to it, though we do have a good talk. David also is offering anyone that would like to write in his Crow world that has read the books and enjoys the settings, enjoys the characters, and you may have an idea for a story, a short story, anybody that's interested can get a hold of him. I'll put his website on the show notes. And if you write a short story, he'll curate them to compile into a short story collection. So if you're looking for a collection to get into, this could be it. Check out his book and you might find something that you really enjoy and would like to be a part of. So it's nice, David, to offer this. Check it out if you're an author looking for some world to write in. I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas. If you've noticed, there have been two episodes coming out each week, and this particular episode has the interview and then a separate episode with a chapter read, which I've been doing with some of the authors who would like to do that. So it ends up being 3-4 episodes per week. That's because I've had so many people want to be on, so many people want to get back on, so many people wanting to read their chapters. Everything's gotten very busy with Discovered Wordsmith, so I hope you're enjoying things. Let me ask, if you are listening to it and enjoying it, go check out the author's books. Give them some love. They work really hard to get these books out, and that's one of the issues David and I talk about, is how hard it is to get a book out and make some money. You might spend 100 hours on it and make $100 off of it if you're lucky. So the authors, the reason I wanted to do this is to help authors that are struggling, authors that are trying to figure out how to make some money with selling books and entertaining people by doing that, by letting their creative urges and juices flow. Okay, there you go. But that would help a lot. And to help the podcast, if you're listening to it, that's great. Let somebody else know that, hey, check this podcast out. Listen to some of these authors and read their books. And if you go to your podcast provider, the app, Apple, wherever it is, give us a thumbs up, give us some stars, give us a review. It would help a lot. The more reviews a podcast gets, the easier it is to be discovered. The easier we are to be discovered, the more people will listen, and the more people will find some books that they want to read. It's a win-win. There's a lot of readers out there looking for the next new book they like, the next author that they really enjoy, and this could be it. But if they don't find the podcast, they're not going to find that author. So please, just take a moment, give us a review and some stars and a thumbs up and a like or whatever it happens to be. It would be very much appreciated, especially at the holidays, right? That's an easy thing to give. So anyway, here is David, and stick around for the chapter read of his book. When we're done with the interview, it'll be a separate podcast episode. David, welcome back to the podcast. It's good to see your face this time, now that we got connected. So tell us a little bit about how things are going with Crowman.
So Crowman is going well. It's expanded somewhat to become part of a 3-book series. Book 2, Crow Tower, is out now. And book 3, Crowbait, is in the works, doing quite well. I'm about 3/4 of the way through, and I'm excited for it. I think I'm liking for where it's going, yeah. And I think if you like Crowman, I think you will Crow Tower very much as well. I think it's It really expands the universe that we started to create, this dark world where the world is kept, the sun is kept captive, and it expands the understanding of what's going on there and why it's happening and what the effects are. It also explores the world where the 12 high priests of darkness are constantly reincarnated, and it investigates that in terms of whether being reincarnated is a blessing or a curse, particularly if you're being reincarnated by the dark spirit and forced to serve him for eternity, basically. But it also starts to look at how you can escape from this hell, and that theme really carries on into Crowbait, where the opening scene has the High Priest of Darkness burying his daughter, and has a conversation to stop her body being ripped apart by Jackal, and has a debate with God about who's really to blame for what's going on.
When you released your second book, did you see an increase again in sales on your first book? I hear that happens quite often.
So I did see some, yes, absolutely. But what I would say is that the traction that I had with the first book was markedly more prominent than with the first book. We actually had a release party online. If we'd been better planned on the first book, maybe we would have done that too. But it sort of went from, we've got a release party arranged, oh, there's a pandemic.
Oops.
Now we were in the pandemic and we knew what we had to do. So in a funny kind of way, Crowman suffered from not having a release, whereas Crow Tower did have a release, and there was really a lot of interest at the thing, and the feedback, the release was really, when are we getting book three? Which is feedback you want people right. to be enjoying your work and to be discussing it and looking forward to it and getting it, basically just getting it, really. And I see what this is about. Have you considered this? There was a suggestion, Stephen, and I might actually make this suggestion to you, that I, while they're waiting for book three, could we get some short stories or something to tide them over? And I threw that suggestion back at them and said I would be happy to curate short story collection set in the Crow Tower world. And I would be happy to have any volunteers that wanted to be part of that. If anyone that is out there, yourself included, would like to take me up on that offer, I think that would be really quite an exciting thing to do, to have.
And Amazon did this for a while. They called it Amazon Worlds, where you could, as an author, put your world into here and other people could write in that. I think that's great. And actually, that's something I've talked to a couple of authors about. I think that's pretty cool, because you get a totally different perspective, maybe even things you didn't even think about for your own characters or stories or world or situations. I think that's pretty cool. I'll make sure and make a note of that.
Yeah, and even like the writing world, though it's vast, it's also it's very connected. And there's people have written short stories that I know. So you could just shift the setting there and that could be in my world. And I think it would be great. And I've done collaborative work in the past and I really love it, mostly with my nieces. They're quite a bit younger than me. And we've done collaborative work that we've had published online in various forums and things. And there's a real buzz that you get from seeing these kids, and they're not kids now, but getting stuff in and saying, look, this is something you can do.
And was this collaborative writing in your Crow world, or was
else? No. So basically, they had written short stories, and I said to them, these are really good short stories. Have you thought about publishing them? And they're like, what we could do is, if we make this 200-word flash, I guarantee it will go on. We can find some place to get it on. Oh, okay. So my role really was just as the editor, to prune 2,000 to 200 and to look at what the story was. And they, I didn't do all of it. They signed it off and said, yeah, that's fine. We sent it. was up. We got it on various different websites. And of course, the great thing about flash fiction is that the same story can be 50 words, 100 words, 200 words. And as long as it's under 1,000, I guess, it still counts as flash fiction. So
yeah,
they've been in a few places with these stories. And yeah, it's great fun.
Besides looking at doing some short stories and some other things, you mentioned you didn't really get a release party for The Crow. So now that you've got two books out, what are some of the things you're doing to market and get the book out there, get the word out?
So I have to confess, I'm not the world's biggest marketer. I think in terms of marketing, the big things are that now that we're not in lockdown, I hope to be able to attend some book fairs and Comic-Con and actually sell through that. I think podcasts are a good way to do it. And really, another good way actually is if you do have submissions, successful submissions onto these online forums, that people go and say,
sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
They say, what else have you done? And there you go. And also, there's a bit of promotion on Twitter that I do and some on Facebook. But I do work full time, so it's not something I can do an awful lot of, and I still think of this as a hobby, so I'm not looking to invest into this, convert it into a major income stream. But in having said that, I think there are things you're better placed to know how to market it than I am. I'm not an expert on it by any means. You can send it to sites and review sites, and sometimes you get sales from that as well. Sometimes not as many as you'd think. But, you know, July, I got my half-yearly check-in for it, and it was enough to pay for a hotel room away for a night away. And, nice. You know, that was nice, a little treat that we wouldn't perhaps otherwise have had. Again, I think it's this idea of building traction and building your credibility as a writer. If you've got one book out on your own, quite hard to market that. Whereas if you've got three, then there's a sense of acceptance that this guy is a writer. This guy's got a story. I'm not going to read this story and then he's gone and right. I'm never going to hear from him. There's three books here. If I like it, I can go on and read more. He's going to be writing. So I think that's also very important. And I think that a lot of it is also about word of mouth, that people read your book and actually tell you. You know, I was out today with a friend who had been reading Crowman, and he was telling me his perspective on it. And it was really interesting to hear. And also, it's a bit of a buzz to hear that someone has been reading your book. And what they're thinking. He felt there wasn't enough sex in it. No, that's not true. He said that there was quite intense tension in some of the relationships, and he kept expecting there to be sex. That's not the same as saying there wasn't enough.
So with your writing, now that you're on the third book, are you doing anything different, or what do you feel you've learned now that you're on the third book?
So I think actually in both two books, when I look back on them, there's things that I think, maybe I should have changed this bit, maybe I should have changed that bit. And I think what I've learned is this: there's no rush. Make sure that the book is where you want it to be. And sometimes you write and you feel that a book has to be a certain length or a certain size, and you're like, I don't know if I want to. And, but if you take things out that aren't necessary and make the book flow better, that writing is still there and you can use it in other parts and other sections of your writing. We're talking about short stories. There are bits that I've taken out already from the first two books that could easily become part of a short story.
I agree. It is hard to pull your own stuff out because you wrote it and you want to keep it all. Mm. But I've been wanting to write a series of stories like Goosebumps, the kids' Goosebumps book, yep, where they're just a little bit scary for the young kids, but more silly, goofy, that type of thing. And I wrote a couple stories, and I'm reading these going, oh my gosh, these are like so dark. I can't give these out to like fourth and fifth graders. No one's going to read them. So I saved what I had, like a snapshot, and then I cut out like the darkest stuff and rewrote it so it's more lighthearted, and it works much better for middle grade. So you got to do what's best for the story and your audience. Definitely.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And sometimes there's interesting things that come out from when you talk to people. So one of the things that came out, one of the critics of Cro-Magnon felt it didn't have enough female voices in it, and that the female characters weren't sufficiently prominent. I would dispute that, and when I was at the book launch, I mentioned this to the audience, and my publisher, who is a woman, was quite insane. But I said, look, let's not quibble about whether it meets this test or whether it does. Let's just say, how can I make female voices more prominent in my writing? Because I would like to do that. I thought I had done it, but there's no denying. As you can see, face to face, I'm male, I'm pale, I'm stale. So it's quite possible that I can fall into these errors. So I'd like to do better. And the suggestion that came back was female point of views into your writing. And it was just like a light bulb went on. I went, oh, that's a brilliant idea. So I've included female points of view into my writing. And it's been of great benefit to me. It's helped to move the stories on further and quicker, and given it a depth to it that I don't think was necessarily missing from the other books, but was not as prominent. So it having dynamics that are entirely about women and about how they treat each other and how they judge each other, and women aren't any nicer to each other than men are. So it's actually been quite interesting to have this point of view from these female characters, and it's been very interesting.
Nice. And I remember reading about Stephen King when he was writing Carrie, which was his first big book, and how he basically said, I am not a teenage girl, I don't know anything about this, I threw it away, but Tabitha pulled it out of the trash and helped him get all the parts right, so it sounded and felt like it was from female. And I know, as you said, we're both a similar age and we're both white males, so it can be hard to write from a female perspective, and everyone starts yelling, hey, you need to do this. So when you do it, they're like, you're not a female, how do you know about that? So there's a tricky balance, and you'll always get those detractors mad at you one way or the other. So what have you done to help make sure you're getting the voice right? Your wife read it, your nieces, or what are you doing?
That's a really good question. And alpha readers and beta readers are a great resource that you definitely should take. I also think that in a funny kind of way, I do not have to justify writing a female voice. And I don't need to have my female voice to be paragon of feminism. That maybe sounds a bit harsh, but I don't feel that it's my job as a writer to produce a polemic about the ills of the patriarchy and how we can rectify. Woman in Crow Bay is an old elderly woman. She is fairly religious. She's quite judgmental. She's fairly proficient in a lot of things. Feminists don't have to like her. They just have to recognise that as a genuine female. You want to call it a stereotype, that's fine, I can live with that. But it's genuine and it's real, and it's my experience and it's my recollection and my understanding of someone like my dear granny, who had lots of faults, I've no doubt about it, but that she was a real person, warts and all. And I'm not apologising for writing from that and from the memories and my understanding of women. I'm around women all the time. I'm sure you are as well. I wish I was part of a patriarchy that could put them down sometimes. Maybe I should edit that out.
Well, I know for me, because I write middle grade, I've got middle grade girls age-wise in there along with boys. And I've got teachers, I've got parents. So I've got men and women and girls and boys. And maybe I'm not right, and maybe it doesn't come across right sometimes, but I just treat them as characters. Just because it's a girl doesn't mean she's going to be humble and submissive and weak. But I also don't feel the need to promote women power. And don't take that wrong. Oh my gosh, he's down against women. But my books aren't about promoting feminism or women breaking the glass ceiling or anything. That's just not what my books are about. Mm-hmm. And it would be disingenuous to write that way. So, and
if you had gone along that line, what you're actually doing, in my opinion, is you're starting to write about exceptionalism.
Yeah.
And I think that's not the best way to promote women and say, oh, y'all should be like Margaret Thatcher, or you should all be like Beyonce, or you should all be like... It's a bit like if you were to write all your male characters, and all of them were Navy SEALs, and all of your male characters were sports jocks, or all of your male characters were successful businessmen called Blake Carrington and all the rest of it. So stereotyping is not unique to women by any means. And if the greater diversity that you have, so if you think of the characters in literature that you love, it's not the winners. It's not the winners. You don't, in comic books, it's the winners you like. You love Superman and Batman. We're talking about something else here. We're talking about a consideration of the human condition. Okay, maybe I edit that out because that's just on grounds of pompousness. But that's what we do. And the human condition for the vast majority of people isn't that I'm going to live in an apartment overlooking Times Square and not in Manhattan, because the majority of us aren't going to do that. I don't know. It's still time for us. Can I see Times Square out your window?
No, that's Ohio. We're pretty far away. Okay. You see cow country.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just not. There are places for that, and there's nothing wrong with reading John Grisham and all these high-powered lawyers and all the rest of it. But, you know, that's not really... I can't even really remember off the top of my head any John Grisham characters, never mind ones that I particularly, whereas I can remember plenty of others, and that you like them because of who they are, what they've done, and how just ordinary people have done things that are extraordinary that perhaps you don't really notice.
Right. And that's the thing. I'm not trying to promote an agenda one way or the other women or men are stronger or not stronger or whatever, because mine's a fantasy world, and some of them know magic and some don't. And I've got men and women with magic, and I've got men and women that are the most powerful magicians across the board. In fact, in my book, the Magic Council, the leader of the Magic Council is a woman. And I didn't make that choice. I better put a woman in here and make her powerful so people don't get upset. It was just the character in my head. When it was forming in my head and I'm writing it, it was a woman and it just fit, and the name came and the mannerisms and all that. It was just, that's who she is. So I think that's more important, is just men, women, leaders, not leaders, boys, girls, whatever, just they're treated the same across the board. That's where we're trying to get to anyway.
So I have to admit there is misogyny in my book, but my books are not promoting misogyny. It's not saying this is the way things should happen. It's saying this is part of the horror, the way these people are treated because of their gender. And this is things that we need to look at and understand and overcome. So I guess there is a bit of an agenda in my book. Maybe there's a bit more polemic in it than I really thought.
But sometimes, though, and I've had trouble with this with some people, if you have a character who is, let's say, one of the Ku Klux Klan, white racist Ku Klux Klan member, and they treat people poorly based on their skin color. If you put that character in your book, you're putting them in there because that's part of the world. You want that character in there. But then some people get upset, like you're promoting it, you're pushing your agenda. And that's not it. Sometimes you have to have that character to provide the counterpoint to what your other characters are, your heroes, or what you're trying to get across. And if you didn't have some of that tension, maybe your particular story needs it. I'm not saying everybody should throw Ku Klux Klan members in their books, because hopefully they all end poorly for the KKK members. But I think it needs looked at as the story, not just, oh, that character. And people get upset about that sometimes.
Yes, they do. And it's always worth listening to what they say and reflecting on it and seeing, is there some truth in that? And can I write better in the future to address that? I think sometimes somebody says, oh, blah, like my publisher was really mad when if they felt this book was a bit, the women weren't really represented. And I understand where she's coming from too, that that there is this sense of judgment about things, but you just need to step back from that and say, so how could I have done this better in a way that would have incorporated that and made it better? And incorporating female points of view more, in particularly in Crowbait, has been something, you know, I'll take that on board and I'll bring it on board. It's if you say something wrong and it's offensive to somebody and they say, oh, that was offensive, then you say, let me reflect on, let me do better.
I agree.
And move on and improve and be a better person. That's what all of us want to do. And you don't need to. It's, if you were going to read Rudyard Kipling, and there are still people that do read Rudyard Kipling, you will find offensive sexism and racism in those books. Not to excuse that in any way, it does. You have to look at that from the understanding of the individual that was writing it and move on past that and see what was good about that book and what wasn't. Let's say Huckleberry Finn, that's probably a better example, because that's...
Yes, yeah.
Millions of people still love Huckleberry Finn and read it every year. And they don't go, oh, that Mark Twain, I don't know about him, he's a bit of a racist. And he certainly was not the kind of man that would be wearing a Ku Klux. But his understanding of what was appropriate to ways to think about peoples of other races and colours is not the same as you and I. We would never use language of that, and we would never think of other people from other races in that way. Only because our understanding of these issues is better. We should be thankful for it, not condemning other people that haven't had that same.
And my point, and I know people would get on me because, hey, you're a white guy, you can't say those things about Huckleberry Finn in particular. I've talked about that example before. But a couple things to remember is, number one, that was the world, how it existed and that he lived in. So he was writing what the world was like then. If we write now about people who don't want to take the vaccine, in 100, 150 years, are people going to be condemning our book because we were writing poorly about people that didn't take the vaccine? Same type of thing. Number two, we're told as authors, write what people want to read. At that time, since it was about that world, it fit. And that's what people would read. If he was writing about it differently, they might have looked at, what the heck is this? And they wouldn't have bought it.
And in defense of Mark Twain, he does subvert these racial stereotypes in very subtle ways. Probably yes. Not enough. As you say, I'm not black. I can't say how offensive Huckleberry Finn
right.
is. There is something about it when you're reading about they remain admirable. They're misunderstood and not understood, but there is a respect for people of colour in there. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there is also a bit of admiration for them as well.
And even though there's some coarse language and words we would not use nowadays, they were thought differently at that time. But Huckleberry himself is friends with Jim. He doesn't treat him so much as an underling as he does a friend. And I think that's missed sometimes because of the language, or because of him calling him Slave Jim sometimes. That was a common way of talking. And again, if Mark Twain wrote it differently, people might have condemned it at that time, because who does he think he is? And not saying he should, whatever. That's a whole nother debate, but it's 150 years ago. Point is, it's difficult, and sometimes you have to make choices. And like you said, I don't want to condemn stuff that's that old. Take it in context of the time period, too.
And there probably is stuff from that time period where if you and I read them, we would say stuff context, this is not something I'm going to read. I can't think of any examples just now, but Kipling comes close, I have to say.
Kipling comes close.
Stuff about the white man's burden and stuff like that. In fact, he doesn't come close. Stuff like that, I just find offensive.
And this sounds snarky. It's really not meant to be. But you change cultural perceptions. If Disney made a Huckleberry Finn cartoon, they would change it so it doesn't have all that offensiveness. And that's the story people would remember more. We've got Jungle Book, and the Disney Jungle Book doesn't really have the racism that some of the other, the real books do.
I don't think the Jungle Book has a lot of racism in it. I think it's more some of his poetry. And there is actually quite a bit of racism in Kim, but it's more observed than actually central to the story. It's an observed racism. But yeah, I do struggle quite a bit with Kipling.
Got it. And like you said, it's something we just got to keep trying to improve on. Neither one of us, it sounds like, is trying to talk down to anybody else. Men, no. Women, black, white, Asian, South American, doesn't matter. I think some people just need to express their thoughts without it turning to anger and violence. That's my biggest problem. I'm willing to talk and listen and, like you said, improve. Okay, before we get going here, because it's always fun to chat and talk, I love what you offered about Cro-Man. I'll put the word out about that. But do you have any last minute advice for authors who have been trying to get their first book out and now they're looking at you because you're getting your third book out?
So I think one of the things, and you're probably the same, when you look back on your writing as a whole, I approached my writing to begin with something that I did for myself, which is good and really excellent, something that I'm really happy about. I did this for myself. But what you have to remember, to be published, you have to write for somebody else, and you have to take what you've written and turn it into a narrative, a story that you're directing at somebody else. And therefore, you've got to think very carefully about who you want that story to be for and what that story is. And in between writing Cro-Man, I've been involved in another project. It's a retelling of the story of Cupid and Psyche around late Victorian, early Edwardian, turn of the century. It's set in upper-class England, and it involves travelling across Europe into Turkey and things. And it took me a long time. Loved the story from the beginning, enjoyed it. Everything flowed really natural, blah, blah, blah. Beta readers loved it. And I got an edit on it, and they said, so you've told me your book is steampunk, but your book's not really steampunk. It's just got elements of steampunk. Make that steampunk more prominent in the book, and don't send them to Turkey. Just invent a land and send them there instead. And I thought really hard about it, and then I realized that she's right. The book isn't steampunk, and the audience, that the people I'm writing this book for, is not for steampunk. And then, having thought that through and realized that, I had to or I'm in the process of redrafting that whole book for the people I want to tell that story to. And then realizing that these are the people that I want to speak to folk. I guess really what that comes down to is know your genre, which is easier said than done, particularly when we chop, 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 chop. And out of interest, wait till I tell you this. I discovered that my book is actually a fantasy of manners. Who even knew such a genre existed? All of the inspirations for the story. I'm struggling now, but the oh gosh, I'm on the spot here, and I'm thinking, help me out. So Michael Moorcock, Jane Austen, even though that's a comedy of manners, not a fantasy of manners. These, all of these people that I guess Philip Pullman could be included as a fantasy of manners. It's not, the book really isn't about Zeppelins and demons. It's about something else. It's about the creating this society. It's a fantasy society rather than a fantasy technology. Maybe I should Google this and tell you what it says on the Google page.
No, that's,
I'm not going to do it. Do it. You can do it later. But know your audience, know your genre, know exactly what you're going to do. Know exactly what books you are copying. Oh, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell was one of them. Know exactly what the books that you think your book should stand next to on the bookshelf are, and write into that genre. Or if you've not done it yet, start thinking about it now and rewrite your book so that they are actually sitting exactly where you want them to be. If it means, oh no, I really wanted this book, I really wanted to be rich and famous already and wanted to retire, don't worry about that, because the likelihood is you're never going to be rich and famous. Just make your book as good as you can and get right. It to the people that you think will love it.
Agreed. I like that. Great. All right, David, it's been wonderful catching up to you, talking to you today. I appreciate all the wisdom and the discussion. That was a good talk. I like that. Thank you.
Super. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Discovered Wordsmiths. Come back next week and listen to another author discuss the road they've traveled, and maybe, sometime in the near future, it might be you.